in and more about dopamine neurons, because they aren't all the same. Some dopamine neurons reduce the negative behaviors, while others increase it, and others do nothing at all. Today, I'll be talking to Professor Daniel, and who loves everything to do with navigation, and Professor Rajeshwar, who is more of a dopamine specialist. Sponsorship coming up next. If you want to support the podcast, it'll be great if you listen. But if you want to skip it, skip the next 2 minutes, and that's fine. I'm always looking for ways to improve my memory, focus, mood, and so on. And you can take all these supplements and all these other things, but they're so expensive. But one thing I always find that helps me change my mindset is music. But I've looked into this quite a bit. I've even written a few articles on it. And there's a lot of research showing that specific frequencies of music can improve different things, such as your sleep, your mood, your focus. And I've been using it for quite a while, and it does help. But you only use it, I only use it once or twice a day for about 20 minutes at a time. And I find the effects normally last for a few more hours afterwards, and it's improved focus. It's nothing like crazy, but it's definitely better. It's, to me, I'd say it's the same as drinking like green tea or someone. So I'd use it. And the company I've been using for quite a while is called Brain FM. I did look at a different few companies, but Brain FM just have nicer soundtracks in that way. Like, I could find that I could listen to them repeatedly for a long amount of time. Like, sometimes I just listen to them not for the focus effects, just because I like the sound of the music, but that's me, so I'd give it a try. And you'll find the link in the episode description. And if you click on the link, you get a discount. So, yeah, just give it a try.
Hi, Daniel and Raj. Thanks for coming on the podcast. Could you both tell me a little bit more about yourself?
I'm Raj Awatramani. I'm a professor in the neurology department at Northwestern University. I've been here for about 18 years and enjoying it. Work on dopaminergic neurons. And traditionally, I started from a developmental angle to try to understand where do these neurons originate. But in the last decade or so, I've also become interested in how these neurons, you know, they start from a common source, but then they begin to diversify. So that's occupying a lot of my time over the last decade.
And so I'm Don Beck. I'm a professor in the biology department, also at Northwestern. I've been here for about 11, 12 years now, so enjoying it very much. And so my research really focuses on using optical tools, optical techniques, study the brain, and develop new optical techniques. This is part of my background as well, and my training that I can talk about a little bit later. But we develop new optical techniques, new behavioral systems to study, to access different behaviors in rodents, and then we use those tools to study different parts of the brain. And we've mostly been applying our techniques to studies of navigation circuitry in rodents. And then also more recently to the dopamine system, to neuromodulatory systems in the brain. It's really been, I'd say, through some kind of accidental discoveries using those new techniques that we to this research on related to dopamine that we'll talk about today.
And like, why did you get interested in science in the first place? Was it from a young age, or was there some sort of event later on in your life that you just thought, science is something I want to do now?
I would say it's from a young age. I've always been interested in all the sciences. But, you know, as a young boy, playing around with animals and snails and frogs, and kind of found it really interesting to understand the basis of life, various forms. Then, of course, it always takes good mentors along the way. So a good high school teacher, good teachers in undergraduate, great mentors at the PhD level and postdoctoral level, and great colleagues, and that sustained my interest all these years.
And the same question to you, Daniel. What got you interested in science, especially neuroscience in particular?
I'd say it was much later on neuroscience for me. I mean, science in general, I was interested in at an early age. I grew up in a small town in New Mexico called Los Alamos. It's all in the news now from the Oppenheimer movie. You know, that's where they made the first atomic bomb and finished making the bomb. The town, U.S. government opened a national lab to do weapons research, but also to do basic science research. And so my dad worked at the lab doing basic science research. He was a physicist. And so I used to go to the lab with him and got me interested from an early age. Also, the science fairs, the whole town was centered around the lab. Like every aspect of it had something to do with, everybody worked at the lab. And so the science fairs when I was in elementary school were just these phenomenal projects that everybody had. It was, sort of like a proxy battle between all of the scientists at the lab through their kids, I guess you could say. So we were all doing projects that were probably a little bit beyond our means at, the third grade level. But we learned a lot. Like my third grade project was a electromagnetic rocket launcher, which, I learned a lot from. The inspiration came from my father. That was all, just sort of living and breathing science town when I grew up kind of really got me interested. I did my undergrad and then my PhD work in physics, sort of following in my father's footsteps. But I was just always more drawn to biology, similar to Raj, crawling around in the canyons in Los Alamos, catching snakes and frogs and stuff. And
any poison snakes, I'm guessing.
There were poisonous snakes for sure. Yeah, there were rattlesnakes up there. You had to be careful. I guess it was through mentors, as Raj said, that, encouraged me along the way and just, sort of pushed me toward what my passions were, my interests were. And I got interested in biophysics first in my PhD work. And there we were making new optical tools, new types of microscopy, techniques to study. We didn't really know what, but they were interesting tools. And a lot of the tools ended up having most of their applications to neuroscience, having the best applications. And so that's what really kind of got me into it. I was like, with my background in physics and engineering, you can apply a lot of that to neuroscience and have some impact.
Now moving into the paper, what would you say are the three main findings of the paper?
Well, let me start and then I'll hand over to Dan. We start the paper with a description of the diverse flavors of dopaminergic neurons. And we do that using single nucleus sequencing, which allows you to derive the transcriptome of single dopaminergic neurons. And then you can cluster them based on their similarities. And using that, we found that there's many different flavors of these dopaminergic neurons. And then the paper, we developed genetic tools to target some of these dopaminergic neurons specifically to study them in isolation. And then we reveal that some of these have very unique projections within their target structure called the striatum, neurons that we've identified with molecular distinct transcriptomes may be also functionally distinct. And that's when, we collaborated with Dan's lab to assess the functional differences of these molecularly different dopaminergic neuron subtypes.
Yeah, so I guess I'd call that one or two main findings there. I mean, I guess the diversity based on molecular expression and then also diversity based on projection that, Raj has discovered. And then, another discovery that we made in the paper, I'd say, kind of the main piece that kind of bridged the two things together is that the function of those different dopamine subtypes was actually defined by the molecular basis, by the molecular categorization of those subtypes. So the subtypes that Raj's lab gave, found and gave us access to label groups, when we studied when and, and how those neurons were active, the different subtypes were active at different times and correlated to different parts of behaviors. And so that was a very important discovery. And then I'd say the third thing, if we want to highlight a third point, was that one of the subtypes that we found was correlated just to movements of the animal and not reward signaling at all. And so that really kind of goes against the dogma that's out there about dopamine neurons that they all signal to reward.
Yeah,
That's their main function. And so here we found a subtype that doesn't seem to care about reward at all, and has a strong motor-related signaling pattern, and it's molecularly defined. It's a genetically defined subtype that we can access that has those properties.
Mm-hmm. And what were the three subtypes? What were the protein names that allowed you to identify that, okay, this is one subtype, this is another subtype? Why do you think that allowed for this cluster of neurons expressing the certain protein to be a separate subtype? Like, what does that protein do? Do we know?
Yeah, so the three subtypes, we call them, we define them by the expression of either an exon 1A1 or VGLU2 or Kelbinden expression. Mm-hmm. Now, these should be viewed as genes that are enriched in those subtypes. We don't know the function of some of these genes. In the case of VGLU2, we do know that it's the glutamate transporter. And so it's used by those neurons to co-release glutamate. In the case of Kelbinden, a calcium binding protein, which there's some literature that it might be protective for the neuron in Parkinson's disease. For an XNA1, there's very little literature on its function in the dopamine neurons, but we do know that it's likely to be highly vulnerable in Parkinson's disease.
Because I do find that interesting, because one of the main symptoms of Parkinson's disease is movement kind of loss and inaccuracy of movement. And could it be down to somehow this protein not being properly expressed, or do you think it's just these proteins are more this neuronal subtype is more available to damage?
Well, I would say it's likely the case that it's the annexin A1 neurons that are more susceptible to neurodegeneration. And it may even be broader than the annexin A1, but definitely the annexin A1 neurons are likely more susceptible. And that we know that by their location at the ventral aspect of the substantia nigra, which for decades has been known to be more vulnerable in Parkinson's disease. And we've known that by postmortem and by studies on postmortem human brains.
What do you mean by more vulnerable? Do you mean in terms of the neurons die faster, or you find oxide nuclein more present there?
Yeah, the neurons, when we say more vulnerable, we mean those have a higher propensity to be lost over time and in the Parkinson's brain.
In Parkinson's disease, do you know if the damage occurs in that area? Is that the first place that's damaged, or is it some other area in the brain?
There's a lot of debate on this in the literature, and I'm not going to comment on, there's these ideas that it may start in the caudal brain and then progress rostrally. That's called the Braak hypothesis. That's basically was evaluated using synuclein staining on a variety of human brains. Mm-hmm. But there's other models as well, some of which suggest that it might start in outside the brain, like in places like the gut, and then unknown mechanisms be transmitted through structures in the brain. Not sure which of these are, correct. But, from our point of view, we know the dopamine neurons are one of the most integral parts of this disease, the vulnerability of these neurons. And the reason we know that is because the treatment of this disease is levodopa, and it seems to work. Mm-hmm. It's one of the treatments that shows substantial reduction of symptoms, at least in the early disease. And, so that's part of the reason we've focused our attention a lot on the substantia nigra, which is the region that contains dopamine neurons.
Just to add to that, there are at least some schools of thought that suggest that, the disease might start in the, in the SNC or in the midbrain region, right? But it's a major open question at this point where it actually begins. But at least within the dopamine neurons, it does seem to begin in the ventral tier region of the substantia nigra, where these motor-related neurons that we found reside.
Do you find these motor neurons in other areas of the brain? Are you thinking of looking into these other neurons, or are the other dopaminergic neurons, do they have other functions apart from movement or reward?
Nearly all the dopamine neurons are in this midbrain region, either the substantia nigra or the VTA, the ventral tegmental area. Mm-hmm. There are a few and some smaller, little nuclei around that have, far fewer in number release, bulk dopamine to the brain. There are certainly other motor related neurons in different parts of the brain, the motor cortex, striatum, brainstem areas as well. But at least dopaminergic neurons, we think that dialed in and found where most of the motor related dopamine neurons are in the substantia nigra.
And how exactly did you measure the activity of the neurons? For example, how did you look in the mice to see whether this neuron was active for this when you did a certain activity?
Yeah, so we used optical techniques. So the field in neuroscience has been working for decades to get to the point where it is now, where we can use a genetically defined subtype of neuron and cause it to express a fluorophore that mm-hmm. is sensitive to calcium or sensitive to neural activity. And we use calcium mm-hmm. as our measure of neural activity. So we used what's called GCAMP. It's a genetically encoded calcium indicator that through the mouse lines that Raj's lab makes, and with mm-hmm. Some constructs from our collaborators, we were able to specifically label one subtype or the other using these tools. And so the neurons would glow green with this genetically encoded calcium indicator, and then when the neurons were firing, when they were active, you'd see more fluorescence coming from them mm-hmm. and less when they were less active. And so we then stuck an optical fiber, a very thin optical fiber, down into the striatum to record from the axons of those mm-hmm. dopamine neurons in the target region, or into the midbrain to record from the cell bodies of those neurons. And in both cases, we saw similar signals, for a particular subtype. So very similar signaling in the soma and the axons. But those signaling patterns we could then correlate to, either movements of the mouse, times when the mouse received rewards, time when the mouse received an aversive stimulus. And by looking over many mice and many, many different trials, we could pretty easily figure out the signaling correlations of the different subtypes.
And why did you want to look at the cell soma and the cell axons? Why would you look at both?
There's a big debate in the dope field right now about just what exactly controls dopamine release in the striatum. So, the first order model in neuroscience is that you've got a cell body, it fires an action potential, the action potential propagates down the axon, where it triggers, vesicles to bind and release neurotransmitter, right? And so it's the cell body firing that really defines neurotransmitter release in the target zone. But there's some work that's shown that for dopamine neurons specifically, the axon terminals can actually be under local control by interneurons in the striatum that release a neuromodulator. They release acetylcholine, and that acetylcholine release can drive dopamine release from the dopamine terminals. So independent of somatic firing, there's a mechanism to lead to dopamine release in the striatum. And so there's a big debate. So that was several studies that had done work in brain slices. And so it's been really unclear in vivo in the behaving animal what is actually driving that dopamine release. And so there's been a few studies just this year, ours is one of them, addressed this subject. And it looks like the sort of first model of, neuroscience is the one that's likely, sort of predominantly at work, that it's the somatic action potentials triggering the dopamine release. Because in our particular case, when we looked at specific subtypes and recorded somas and axons, we saw very similar signaling between the two, suggesting that the somas were sort of driving the release in the axons. Now, if you don't have the subtype specificity that we did, Thuraja subtypes, and you just label all dopamine neurons and stick a fiber into the soma region and another one into the axon region, you can find very dissimilar signaling. And so that was interpreted by some groups as, to the idea that acetylcholine driving the release in vivo. But our interpretation is just that those studies had recorded from different subtypes from the soma versus the axon regions.
And when you were measuring reward and avoidance with the rats, how did you do that? What did you use as a reward and avoidance behavior?
So we used, for reward, we used water. So the animals are on what's called water scheduling. So they receive water only at a particular time during the day. And so that teaches them that when water is available at other times, they should, you know, work for it or look for it, basically. So water becomes a reward for them. So that was the rewarding stimulus that we gave them. And then for the aversive stimulus, we used an air puff to the face. So these were head fixed mice. Their heads were fixed in place. Mm-hmm. And then they were running on a treadmill. And so we could just position an air puffer, you know, next to their whiskers, basically. And it's aversive. It's not something that the animals like, but it's not as aversive as a shocking stimulus, for example. So it's something that we could, you know, apply repeatedly in an aversive way without worrying about, you know, over aversion. Do we answer all your questions?
No. I'm just deciding which question to ask next. Okay. Because the flow. And I'm wondering, because you recorded the activity from the neurons, do you think that could help with electrical stimulation? For example, because if you know what frequencies to stimulate the different neurons to cause the activity, do you think you could maybe cause the stimulation of the neurons that are more susceptible to damage?
I'll start with an answer, but Raj, you should follow up. I think, you know, you've thought quite a bit more about the clinical implications, but that relies on there actually being neurons there to stimulate, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like, you know, if neurons in the ventral tier, these Ankson neurons, as we call them, if they die and their axons aren't there in the striatum anymore, and there's no other neurons that grow axons into that region, then it really doesn't matter. You know, there's nothing to stimulate to drive, you know, movements, right? Now, if there's enough of the axons left, maybe, you know, if we knew that signaling pattern, we could try to, you know, overdrive the axons that are left to compensate for some of what's left. Or, you know, there's other ideas with like little micro pumps or something to try to lead to, you know, correctly timed dopamine signaling. But, you know, those are, I'd say, sort of futuristic. I mean, that's the idea, is that this, the first thing we need to know is what we found here. And that's, what are the signaling patterns of the different neurons projecting to which regions? And then the next question is, you know, in a disease like Parkinson's, when some of those neurons die, how do you replace that signal?
I would add to that, one really interesting finding in this study was that the calbindin neurons, they were correlated more with, their activity was correlated more with deceleration. And those neurons happen.
What does that mean exactly? Do you mean deceleration as in deceleration of movement?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So when the mouse is on a treadmill and it decelerates, that's when you see these activity in these calbindin positive neurons. Now, it turns out these neurons are relatively spared in Parkinson's disease. So we know in post-mortem human brain, these neurons are still existent. And so what that means is, so what the implications of that for movement are definitely a future avenue for study between my lab and Dan's lab. What is the implication of having a brain where the neurons that are locked to acceleration are degenerating, but the neurons that are time locked to deceleration are preserved? So what are the implications for movement? And that's the central focus of our work.
Could that be the case that because you've got too much of the neurons that are causing deceleration of movement, and you've got a sparsity of the neurons causing that allow for movement, that could be one of the reasons that you get the movement problems in Parkinson's disease?
Yes, I mean, that's a hypothesis, and definitely we need to test it further. And Dan's lab is pursuing that. And then maybe you can step in on this.
Yeah, so that's exactly, you know, one of our working hypotheses is that it's not just the loss of the sort of acceleration movement driving subtype in Parkinson's, but it might be the sparing of the, you know, deceleration sort of stopping neuron subtype. And so to get at that question, we're using optogenetic techniques where we can, instead of labeling those specific subtypes of neurons with the calcium sensor to look at their activity, we can label those neurons with light sensitive ion channels. And we can use those ion channels then to either activate or inactivate the neurons using light. And so we can turn on and off those different subtypes of neurons at different times. And that's what we're just starting to do now in the lab here and try to determine whether, for example, when we turn on the acceleration subtype, does it cause animals to start moving? And the answer seems to be yes, at least preliminarily. Mm-hmm. And when we activate the deceleration correlated subtype, are the animals more likely to stop? And that's, you know, to be determined, right? Mm-hmm. So that's how we're really addressing those questions.
And do you think that in Parkinson's disease, you've got a difference in the neuron? Is it because neurons that cause the activation of movement, there's less of them? Or do you think there's just a difference in their activation patterns and their signaling? Or could it be both?
I mean, it could be both. I mean, it's in different stages of the disease. It could be, it could be both, right? For example, early on, it could be altered activity patterns in, you know, for example, the acceleration correlated neurons. But over time, as they all start dying, you just lose that signal altogether, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I'd say it's unclear. And it's, you know, it's not exactly clear how the subtypes that we've studied here exactly map onto the subtypes in human, right? I mean, there are some very interesting similarities and expressions, but it's going to take quite a bit more work to really map, you know, the findings that we've made in mice mm-hmm. up to humans.
And why do you think we have neurons that aversive behavior? So why do you think that's the case?
One way to think about it is dopamine is sort of a learning system. You need to learn rewarding stimuli and aversive stimuli. And so mm-hmm. that's one very simple, basic way to think about it. Mm-hmm. You know? By the way, these aversive responsive dopamine neurons have only been discovered, I would say, in the last 10, 12 years. Before, it was thought to be all rewarding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because from my knowledge of like dopamine is always thought to be a reward and like learning, but in a reward sense.
Yeah, and when you know, the textbook still describes this as the brain reward system. And if you go to the media, you know, the common media, even, you know, podcasts like the Huberman podcast or other, you know, they talk about a lot about the rewarding aspects of dopamine. But over the last decade, this is starting to change. And the, you know, subsets of dopaminergic neurons have been found to be responsive to aversive stimuli. And, you know, and that has very interesting implications, which we are also following up on.
Yeah, I guess the only other thing I'd add is that aversive stimuli consist of many components, right? An aversive stimulus leads to a movement oftentimes, right? Aversive stimuli they're salient events, right? And so there's a lot of different variables that have to be teased out that haven't entirely been teased out in the field yet, right? So, you know, now that we know that there are dopamine neurons that respond to movements, you know, some previous studies that have looked at stimuli that cause movements that originally thought that the dopamine neurons were responding to those stimuli, maybe the dopamine neurons were responding to the movement and not the stimuli, right? And because those two things are linked together, it's a little bit difficult to tease them apart, right? Aversive stimuli are, you know, they can be loud stimuli, they can be light flashes. So it might not just be aversive stimuli, but it might be sort of anything loud in the room, even if it's a positive signal for the animal, right? So it becomes tricky to really tease these things apart. But, you know, I certainly agree with Raj's assessment that they're most likely related to, you know, to learning or, you know, learning some sort of sensory motor responses to different types of cue, whether they're appetitive or aversive.
And have you looked to see whether in disease models, or are you going to look to see whether in Parkinson's disease models, these neurons have different activities or different levels of expression?
We are not personally looking at that, but a collaborator of ours is looking into the LRRK2 into a mouse model of the LRRK2 mutation, which is also one of the most common mutations in human. And she's not looking into activity, but she's looking into dopamine release deficits, and they found that in that model, the neurons have not degenerated, but they do see substantial dopamine release deficits. And there's some indications that this release deficit may be regionalized, meaning it might originate in particular subtypes of dopaminergic neurons, but that's a hypothesis we are testing.
And why did you use mice that were 2 to 4 months of age? Was there a particular reason?
So we want to use mice that are already of their close to adult size, so that during the study they aren't growing and changing in physical size much, right? So we want to make sure they're sort of on the top end of their growth curve already, so that that we don't have to have that variable to worry about. Lab mice after they become 6 months to a year old, these are, a lot of them are very inbred strains, and they have various deficits. Some of them start to go blind, some of them start to go deaf. And so using, younger mice, less than 6 months, but still of the adult size is, what we've found to be kind of the ideal range to do our studies.
Is that typical of mice regardless of the strain, even if it's a different strain of mice? They normally only last like a year, I'd say. Some mice can last 2 years or even longer. But
yeah, they can certainly live longer. It's just whether they're, all of their senses are still completely intact. And so I'd say almost all lab mice that I know of have, at least some deficit, and it depends on the type. This has been, studied. The black six mice that we, is the background for most of the ones that we used. Yep. That's what I know the most about, but the other strains as well that are commonly used in the lab also have some issues that you have to be aware of when you're doing mouse work in the lab.
And do humans have these neurons as well in similar amounts? Do we know from are you thinking of doing further studies to look to see whether humans have the same types of neurons?
Yeah, I think, humans definitely have a substantia nigra. It's, much larger than a mouse substantia nigra, probably I would say 40 times, 50 times, numerically times the size of a mouse substantia nigra. But we're also interested in, mapped out the subtypes of dopaminergic neurons in the mouse, and other studies have mapped out these neurons in human substantia nigra. One thing we're interested in doing is trying to find out what are the correlates of these mouse subtypes in the human substantia nigra. So we're trying to bridge these studies to do that. But another, it's going to be impossible to do experiments on human, obviously. But another intermediate could be considered is the primate model. So if we could study these in a primate model, then you can actually do recordings and things like that, and so use that as a sort of intermediate between mouse and human.
Because you can do single neural recording in humans, I know that, but I don't know how. But you won't be able to do the analysis of the molecular expression. That's the only problem.
Well, molecular expression, you can do it on post-mortem human brain. That's definitely feasible, and that's been done actually by the group of Evan McCosker. But the recordings are very hard to come by, just because of the ethical issues, obviously.
You were giving the stimulus to the mice. Had a 5-second window where you never measured. Why did you leave that 5-second gap?
The 5-second gap between stimuli, is that what you're referring to?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, so we also, we basically want to apply stimuli from some, we want to have some period to compare to, right? So we want to have some kind of baseline period. And so we want at least 5 seconds between stimuli. And usually it was even longer. It was like a minute or even more between stimuli. And what we do in our analysis is we would just sort of chop out the 5 seconds before the stimulus period, and then a few seconds after, and kind of look at that window across all of the different stimuli. And by looking across that window, you can get a good picture of what the baseline firing of the neurons is, and then how it changes after the stimulus. And so you need a good chunk of time before in order to really get a accurate quantitative measure of what that firing is before.
Other work are both of you doing in the lab, like, or planning to do?
In future work?
Mm-hmm.
Related to dopamine?
Yeah, related to dopamine. And then after that, just other work in general.
Well, this, this collaboration with Raj, it started I don't know, what is it, like 9 years ago or 7 years ago now, Raj? So we actually met on a bus. So Raj works at the med school downtown. I work up on the main campus, and we were both on the intercampus shuttle, and we sat next to each other. We kind of knew each other from a previous committee assignment, and we just started talking, and we realized we were working on two different aspects of the same problem, that we were starting to use our optical methods to record from dopamine neurons, and we saw these signals that we didn't think should be there, and that was kind of confusing. And then Raj was working on the genetic subtypes of dopamine neurons. And, you know, it was on that bus ride. We were like, oh, wouldn't it be interesting if there was a connection between the genetic subtypes and the function? And that's, you know, it's 7 years later, we've basically seen that that's true. But this, that collaboration that we started then has just really blossomed into, many different projects, many different labs involved in it. So beyond ours, you know, we have a grant from the Michael J. Fox Foundation, the Aligning Science Across Parkinson's Foundation. And it's R2 Labs and three others that are really trying to understand what these different subtypes, the role that the different subtypes play in Parkinson's disease, what the inputs these different neurons get, what the effects are in different mouse models of Parkinson's, et cetera. And so a lot of the work, you know, that I see going forward for our dopamine work is certainly going to be in, you know, close collaboration with Raj.
Yeah, and one of the things we're interested in is actually what you asked earlier, is trying to look, you know, trying to decipher how to understand our mouse work. How does that correlate with human? And, you know, and that's not an easy question, obviously, but we can begin by looking at the molecular similarities between mouse and human subtypes, and then perhaps develop tools that might be useful to target these subtypes, not only in mouse, but at least in monkeys. And then that would enable us to sort of begin to understand the function of these subtypes in higher organisms. That's going to take a long time, but this is one route forward.
Are you working on anything else apart from dopamine-related things?
Yeah, so I mean, a good chunk of my lab works on dopamine, and then the other part, like I said at the beginning, we developed new techniques to study mouse behavior. So we work on we develop, for example, virtual reality systems for mice, and study spatial navigation behaviors in those mice, and so. Mm-hmm. We can head fix the mice, put them on a treadmill, and their movements on the treadmill connect in closed loop to this visual virtual reality display. And then because they're performing these spatial behaviors in a head fixed paradigm, we can then use really powerful microscopes to image into their brains in ways that you can't do in freely moving animals. And so we have many different projects worked on studying activity patterns in the hippocampus and the entorhinal cortex that are actually even starting to overlap with some of the dopamine work, finding reward signals in those regions. But I'm trying to understand basically how animals know where they are and where they're going.
This is a question like asking, what advice would you give to students who want to enter into your area of research?
Well, I would say, you know, for students, the one thing that, you know, needs to be maintained is why you came to science in the first place. And I came because I really found it interesting to study animals. And like we discussed earlier, influence from, you know, my dad and the mentors and, you know, all that stuff. But to retain that flame, you know, to retain that flame of curiosity and to continue to enjoy the beauty of these questions and these findings, that's the most important, you know, because there's a lot of noise, you know, there's administrative stuff, there's competition, there's, you know, there's a lot of cloudiness, but the central reason we all came here was for the beauty of the science, you know, and that should be preserved. And one should always remember, these are our first principles. This is who we are. We came here for that reason. And let's just stick to that. And then the noise can be dealt with. That's the way I look at it.
That's well said. I don't know if I could say much more. I mean, you know, I guess the only thing I would add is, you know, explore, I guess this ties into what Raj just said, but, you know, for younger students just getting into the field, explore around, make sure you find that subject that you're passionate about, right? Make sure that the lab that you're joining, the project that you're going to spend 5-6 years of your life working on, make sure that that's the one that really gets you up in the morning into the lab. And so try a bunch of different things, right? Don't just, you know, go for what's the easiest, you know, lab to join, the easiest project to do. Find what really gets you excited. And, you know, then it's,
you mean like
it's all about
internships and so on.
Yeah, internships, lab rotations, how, you know, there's a lot of different avenues, but, you know, certainly for PhD students, for example, lab rotations, I think, is very important. But yeah, internships is another way to get at it. But, you know, you've got to enjoy the journey. You know, if you don't enjoy the journey, if you don't enjoy the nitty gritty of science, of the, you know, the day to day building things, fixing things, interpreting data, figuring out why the experiment didn't work, because most of them don't. You know, if you don't enjoy that, you know, there's probably something better for you, right? So you've got to really just enjoy that whole process of doing science. It's not just about, you know, that final outcome and the final discovery. It's much more about the process.
The other thing I would say is very important for students to be able to clearly state the question that they're interested in. And if you can articulate that question clearly, then solving that question becomes more sort of straightforward, more logical. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I notice, especially with younger students, and probably when I was younger too, this was the case, mm-hmm. that the main question is a little bit fuzzy. You know? And so effort needs to be made to articulate that very, very clearly in your head.
What do you do in the spare time that you get from science stuff?
Spare time?
What is it?
Kids. Mm-hmm. You know, they're getting older, so they don't hang out with me as much as they used to. So I'm getting a little bit more spare time, I guess. But I like gardening. You know, that's one of my hobbies, and I love traveling.
Do you travel as in America or further afield or both?
Further afield, all over. I mean, you know, work takes us all over the world, usually giving talks and seminars and teaching classes. You know, I just got back from China. I'm going to Germany next week, you know, but then with the family, a lot of times if it's during the summer, they'll come along on those trips and, you know, I'll have a conference and then we'll stay and, you know, tour around the area. Brought the travel bug, you know, hopefully it's bitten my kids and, you know, they seem to enjoy traveling a lot too. Do you have any spare time, Raj?
Yeah, well, you know, I do travel as well, and that's fun. That's always fun to be in different places and meet different people. Mm-hmm. I listen to podcasts, as I was telling you earlier.
So yeah, that's, same here. I listen to too many podcasts.
Yeah. And, you know, I, you know, play some sports and try to get some exercise and, you know, that type of stuff.
Any particular sports that you play?
Well, you know, I used to play soccer, but I run. I've gotten too, you know, my knees have gotten too wobbly for soccer. But tennis occasionally. And
do you run in competitions? Is it just for general fitness?
No, just general.
Yeah, same here. Like, I think I run 1 10K, and then I was like, competitions aren't fun for me really.
I should reframe that. I actually jog. I don't run. So.
Well, the thing is, for me, jogging and running is like the same. Like jogging and running is the same, and then you have sprinting, which is like short distance. But okay, in my mind, jogging and running is the same thing. Like I think of them. Do you have any particular favorite books or top three books, nonfiction or fiction, that you would recommend? They can be science related or non-science, just any particular favorite books of yours.
Most of the reading I do now are science journal papers. That's pretty much all I have time for. I mean, books that were influential to me, you know, at least, you know, in my education, I really liked Richard Feynman's autobiography books. Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman, and What Do You Care What Other People Think? I thought just hearing his stories of, you know, he was actually involved in building the atomic bomb, for example, but just Manhattan Project.
Because the previous episode that I recorded, the professor on that also recommended the same book.
Oh, really?
It's been on my list for a long time, and I read the book in like 3 days. So
did you enjoy it?
I listened to the book in 3 days because I only listened to it. So
okay,
it was definitely good.
You should listen to it. So a lot of the stories in those books, he had given lectures in like the 80s and 90s. You can find them on YouTube. And it's really interesting to hear in his accent, in his own words, telling those stories. He has a pretty thick New York accent, which is kind of funny. And he's a very, very just approachable, engaging, incredible storyteller. And so not only were the books good, but just hearing him tell those stories were really, really fun, I think. So you should look those up too.
I'll definitely look those up.
Yeah.
You know, my daughter just gave me a copy of the Bhagavad Gita, you know, which is a religious text. It's really interesting because, you know, first of all, you know, I've always known the sort of tenets of that text, but I've actually never been through it. And I started reading it, a translation from the original Sanskrit version. And it's interesting in two ways, because, you know, the first way, there's parts of it which are related to reward and action, you know, and separating those two. And I find it eerily, you know, similar to what our paper looks like, you know.
Dopamine.
Yeah, I find it very eerily similar to that. And so that's real interesting. And then the second interesting thing came up in this Oppenheimer movie where, you know, it turns out he was a scholar of Sanskrit and, you know, and that's why the quote shows up in the movie.
How long is it? How?
Probably 400 or 500 pages, and I'm still very early in, so I don't know where. And, you know, some of it is easier to sort of see in a modern context, and some of it is not. So I just choose what's relevant for myself.
I'll definitely have a look at the Feynman lectures and the book as well, because, well, I like getting these recommendations. I listen to a lot of the books, even I listen to them as audio, like when I'm doing lab work or something, when it's like tedious cell culture or something, I do it at the same time. I'll definitely have a look into that. But that's all the questions I've got. So thank you for coming onto the podcast. It was great talking to you.
Thank you as well.
Yeah, my pleasure. It was great. And like I said, I think it's great that you do this, and it's good to, you know, important to get the basic science out to the public. And this is a great forum to do it.
It'd be great.
Summary. A great episode. I could learn so much about neuroscience. I could literally talk all day to different neuroscientists. But there are always a few fields that particularly interest me. And one has always been the neurochemicals. Another one's inflammation, but that's another matter. But dopamine is one of the main neurochemicals, and that's why I'm always interested in it. I've previously done other episodes on dopamine, but there's always new research coming out, and I think that dopamine is one of the most important chemicals that we need to learn about, and because it controls reward and also navigation and many other important functions. But dopamine, as I mentioned, it's always thought as the neurochemical of reward, but it's more complicated than that, because researchers have found that it causes different activities such as navigation, and it's more thought of now as the neurochemical to do with learning rather than reward. But in this paper, the researchers were looking at dopamine causing different responses in different neurons, and this was due to the different genes they were expressing, which means they were acting in different ways. But first, we'll talk about the scientists. Both Daniel and Rajesh had a will to explore. I think that's something that everyone has, and I think I've mentioned this before, but I think it's important to carry on mentioning it, because one of the key things as a scientist, and also being a proper person, is having that will to carry on exploring different things. It can even just be 20 minutes or 10 minutes a day of doing something new or something different, such as reading a new book, going, doing a different sort of exercise, even just walking to work in a different way. But now onto research. They mainly looked and found that there were three different types of genes that were expressed in the dopamine neurons that segregated it into three different types of neurons. And these three genes were VGLUT2, CALB1, and ANAXA1. And I find this really interesting. VGLUT2 has always been really important in the nervous system. But the other two proteins are not known that much. And VGLUT2 and CALB1 were quite similar in the responses, having been positive reward to stimuli, causing an increase in electrical firing. But then the ANAXA1 was different, it never showed any response. And that was whether the... But then when you had negative behaviors, it did show an increased response. And this is important because... Because ANAXA1 neurons have been shown to be important in Parkinson's disease and are the main neurons present. Later on in the disease, you lose the other two types. This might be why you don't get positive movement behaviors in Parkinson's disease. And as always, I love book recommendations. I've already read Richard Feynman's book because I was recommended by a previous podcast guest. But I still need to read the Bhagavad Gita, and that's a long one, so that'll take me quite a bit of time. But if either of you have read any of these books, feel free to message me about how you found them and what you learned from them.
And it's just the beginning of a full area of research and hopefully lead to better cures and researchers. If you're interested in Alzheimer's disease and you would like to join his lab, check him out. Thank you for listening to this episode, and I would be grateful for a like, a review, or sharing this episode. If you could do one or three of these things, it would be a great help in helping more people get a grasp of neuroscience, which I believe everyone should do. And I will ensure more people, and I will ensnare more people in the net of neuroscience, my evil goal. If you have any comments, be sure to send them to the Brain Explained email, Twitter, LinkedIn, or website, or just leave it on the episode. As a final note, if you want to get involved with the podcast, I would be delighted to have you on board. I always need people to write blog posts about interesting neuroscience, work on the podcast, or on promotion. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I look forward to releasing more interesting neuroscience. So stay tuned to learn more about the brain.